This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Rob Lowe has had boyish good looks for so long, it's easy to resent him as undeserving. As a kid in Dayton, Ohio, he knocked on Liza Minnelli's hotel room door and stayed to chat, have some chocolates before she told him, "See you in Hollywood, kid." And just a few years later, he was, in fact, a Hollywood star. But Rob Lowe is also a child of divorce, a veteran of alcoholism. Some of his career has gone up and down. He's written a great Hollywood memoir, Stories I Only Tell My Friends. And by the way, his friends range from Francis Ford Coppola to Martin Sheen and Michael Dukakis to Mike Myers. Rob Lowe joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
When your family moved to California, you didn't exactly run around with the dead-end kids there, did you, as you look back on it?
Well, no. I mean, for the first time, I met people my own age that wanted to act and that wanted to be filmmakers. And as opposed to being beaten up for it, I found friends who were like-minded, and they were my next-door neighbors, the Sheens. But it was great to fall in with a crowd that had similar likes.
Yeah. Speaking of days as a Hollywood teenager, what was it like to get to the home of a girl named Jennifer and have Cary Grant answer the door?
Well, in a show of exactly how callow I was as a youth, I wasn't really aware of Cary Grant's filmography. Mm-hmm. I knew Cary Granite from the Flintstones. That I knew. Yeah. So when I went to her house and we were going to watch my very first television appearance on an after-school special, and he said, "Young man, do you mind if I watch with you?" I thought, "Yeah, you crazy old guy. Sure, whatever. Come on in." And ignorance truly is bliss, because if I'd have known what I know about Cary, obviously, today, yeah, I would have been petrified. But it worked out great, because at the end, he was very kind and really gracious. And he said, "I thought you were quite good. You reminded me of a young Warren Beatty." Now, Warren Beatty, I knew. So yeah, it was a good day.
You first gathered a lot of attention in The Outsiders, directed by Francis Ford Coppola.
Right.
Of course, that's a film with Matt Dillon, Patrick Swayze,
Tom Cruise, Diane Lane.
Yeah. Let me put it this way. Did you all know you'd be famous?
It's interesting. The movie did very well, but we thought the movie was going to be Star Wars. It was not. We never thought we would all be famous. Mm-hmm. We all were. So it was slightly a different experience from what we thought. I don't think any of us thought that it would be the beginning of, for a lot of us, a very, very, very long, long, long career. But yeah, it was, and it was an amazing, amazing launching pad for many of us.
When did you start drinking in a harmful way?
Well, that's just the thing, is when does it become harmful? I mean, mm-hmm, on The Outsiders, this is how different movie making is. We would get in the van and they would have beers for us. Now, some actors were 15 years old.
Yeah.
I was just 18. And you drink a beer and think nothing of it. So mm-hmm, I started then. And I think incrementally, without even knowing it, it became just a big part of my life, to the point where it was such a part of my life that I decided that I needed to go and get help, and did.
You know, it's inescapable as you read through the book that there were times, let me put this nicely, you're a big star, doing drugs, drinking, having romances left and right.
Or as my mother would say, God rest her, burning the candle at both ends.
And you were not happy, were you?
No, and people say, why is there so much alcoholism and drug addiction around Hollywood? And I don't think it has anything to do with Hollywood. I think that people are drawn to Hollywood who are looking to fill something missing in them. And performing does that. But then when you reach the mountaintop, you realize you're still the same. It didn't fill you up.
Well, 1988 Democratic Convention.
Yes.
There was a new technology called portable video, I guess. And you, two women in a hotel room in Atlanta. This was before YouTube.
It was before YouTube, and also it was the era, just even in politics, where it was still wild and woolly. You know, the tradition of hard drinking, hard charging, political roughnecks was still really alive and well. Conventions were, it's not the sanitized, infomercial, corporate, no surprises allowed conventions that we have today. It's almost unimaginable to go back and remember what that was like. That said, one of those big wild nights, you know, we all go out to a club. I try to get in, and they won't let me in without my ID, which I had left back in the car. So once I finally got my ID and went in, it never occurred to me that anybody else would not be 21. But, you know, I went out, met two girls, had some fun, and used the new technology as everybody does today. I was just a groundbreaker. And it was a different world, different time.
It's amazing. Will you ever note about this, how big that story was?
It's shocking. I mean, this is how I knew I was in some serious trouble. As I turned on the TV, I led the evening news, Tom Brokaw. And the second story literally was,
and in Tiananmen Square today, in the 6,000-year history of China, democratic uprising is rearing its fantastic head.
That was the second story was Tiananmen Square. This is unbelievable. It's now, like, you know, every actor in the world has to have, you know, a naked photo in the internet.
Yeah. I wonder, did your friends stick with you through that? Or I guess we say, did your real friends, did you lose some others and not hear from some other people?
Well, look, I don't want to paint the picture that my real friends deserted me. I certainly had some friends, but I got to be honest. I did a lot of work for a lot of people and traveled a lot of miles on behalf of candidates and, you know, the party and things like that, and they ran for the hills. Yeah. Looking back, I get it. It's called politics for a reason. But it definitely influenced and gave me a new view into what that relationship between celebrities and politicians and activism is really all about at the end of the day.
Well, forgive me for being this blunt to the point of vulgar, but when you say you learned what it's all about at the end of the day, you mean that they're using you?
Yeah, you know what it is? I think that it's celebrities and politicians sort of bask in each other's reflective glory, each one being filled by the other, a part that they're individually missing.
Mm. So you fill in the glamour for them. They fill in the
gravitas.
Yeah. Boy. There's a wonderful poetic touch in the fact that you wind up in the West Wing. Mm. Sam Seaborn writing speeches for President Bartlett, played by Martin Sheen, when you had at least partly grown up at the Sheen household.
Yeah. And so whenever Sam and Martin would have scenes, they were so charged for me.
Yeah.
Because of my history with him, and I like to think that that was captured in the show.
I have to ask this, given the times in which we live. Do you have any thoughts about your old friend Charlie Sheen you'd like to share?
Well, you know, Charlie and I have been in contact up until, it's been about 5 weeks now, but when he began this sort of troubling time, we were talking via text. And, you know, listen, it's tough because I've known him since he was 13, and I love him. And I love Martin and the whole family. And I'm also, you know, 21 years sober, so I have a perspective that's probably unique to his experience. You know, he knows where I am. He knows I'm available. He knows I'm ready to help. But he's doing it his way. And part of me has to, you know, respect that. He's not being a hypocrite. I don't agree with it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it sort of is what it is.
Since you've been there and back, what does make a difference to someone to be able to turn your life around?
You need to literally be done. When I was ready, when I went to rehab, if they told me to go stand in a corner with my clothes off, standing on my head, I would have done it. I was just done. I wanted a new life. Different people take different events to get them to that place. Some people have to go way, way down, and other people don't.
Mr. Lowe, a pleasure. Thanks so much for all your time.
Thank you. This has really been fun. I appreciate it.
Rob Lowe, his memoir, Stories I Only Tell My Friends. And you can hear Rob Lowe read from his book about his friendship with John Kennedy Jr. at NPR.org.
I was just sitting around having a meeting with some of my agents, just talking about, you know, upcoming projects. And one of the things I said was, hey, I know it's Steve's last season. I would love to go do a little guest spot and be in an episode. And that turned into the writers coming back saying, oh, wow, we would love that. What about doing more than one? Would you be willing to do a whole character arc? And I had never done that. I really haven't done much of any sort of episodic television. So, you know, and I didn't have anything going on in terms of film and production. So I said, absolutely, I would love it. And it really was a little intimidating at first, because that's such a that cast is like a, you know, a well-oiled machine, and they know each other so well. So to step into that was slightly intimidating, but they were great. And also too, I mean, I was privy to the fact of how emotional it was for everyone to see Steve leave. You know, I felt honored to kind of be a part of that.
Well, it also gave rise to rumors or suggestions that you might actually
take over
the
cast, yeah.
the show, yes. And the character. Did any of the cast think that?
No, because it was well known going in that I was just doing these four episodes, and so they weren't looking at me sideways saying, are you what's the deal? Are you moving in? You know, they shoot very close to where I live. it was the way they work is so effortless. They shoot very quickly, and there's such a free flow to the kind of the improvisational style, and the writing's really sharp. I did see why people love working on that show.
So fleetingly tempting.
Fleetingly tempting, yes.
But not happening.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Last Mother's Day weekend, by popular demand, comedian Betty White was the host of Saturday Night Live. During her Emmy Award-winning performance, White appeared in a satirical sketch about public radio.
Now, you're unveiling your new muffin today. Are you nervous about how it will be received?
Well, you know, girls, when I was younger, I was so concerned with how my muffin looked. But as I got older, I started to think, to heck with it. This is my muffin, and I don't care how it looks.
That's really progressive.
You go, sister.
That's right, child. I'm Florence Dusty. I'm 88 and a half years old, and I'm proud to unveil my giant Dusty muffin.
Betty White has been on television, in her words, forever. I had the chance to talk to her back in 1995 when she published an autobiography, Here We Go Again, My Life in Television. Betty White's new memoir, If You Ask Me, has just been published. It focuses on the past 15 years of her life and career, and Betty White is in the studio of member station WNYC in New York. How nice it is to talk to you again.
Well, how much fun it is, and thank you again, Leanne.
My pleasure. You are no stranger to television. Have you been offered jobs that you didn't take, that you didn't want to take?
Yes. Oh, yes. Every once in a while, a script comes through or something with something I just won't do. One came in, but it started out with a drunken Santa Claus vomiting. That was the first scene. And somehow it just didn't seem like a musical comedy.
But I bet you are getting a lot of offers now, given that now you're a hit with a new generation.
Well, I think I've been around so long that they kind of think, well, she's always here, so we might as well watch her. And it's fun. You meet friends of all ages when you're on the street.
Sure.
By on the street, you understand. I mean walking down the street.
Right, not when you're working, right?
No.
You know, Betty White, people, audiences, generations of them get a real kick out of a sweet, now 89-year-old lady with a naughty mind. Are you going to contest me on that point?
No, I don't think of it as naughty. I don't like dirty humor.
Yeah.
I like double entendre, because then the people who get it enjoy it, and the people who don't get it don't know about it. And the people who drive me crazy are the ones who say something with a double meaning, and then they poke you in the ribs with their elbow and say, did you hear what I said? Did you get it? You know, I want to go home at that point.
That's like the old Monty Python sketch, nudge, nudge, know what I mean? Your late husband, the love of your life, Alan Ludden, was once asked, how close the character Sue Ann Nivens, the home economist, neighborhood nymphomaniac on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, was to you, Betty White? And his response was, well, they're the same person, except Betty can't cook.
And he was so right.
Well, I'm wondering, did the work that you did then as that character, Sue Ann, kind of help form that public persona with the double entendres and the innuendo today?
Well, not really. Long ago, I did a 5.5 hour a day, 6 day a week talk show for 4 years early on in Los Angeles, local show. And when you're on that many hours with no script, you know, you get very comfortable, maybe overly comfortable with that small audience. As I say, you hit and run. Yeah. If there's a double meaning, you drop it and then you try to get away as fast as you can.
You know, I was surprised in reading the book. You're in a show, hit show, hot in Cleveland right now, and the guy who plays your character's boyfriend is Carl Reiner.
Yes,
he was in the service with your late husband, Alan Ludden.
Well, and bless Carl's heart, it was Captain Ludden, and he was in the this same division. And during World War II, he wrote some material, and he would, you know, he would perform every once in a while just for the guys. And Alan was the one that, I'm quoting Carl now, he said he would not be in the comedy business if it weren't for Captain Ludden, because Alan would say, you have to do that, you have to do more of that.
Your timing is impeccable. And granted, you know, you've had decades to practice it, but on the other hand, some have it, some don't. Is there a secret to it?
Probably listening. You can go past that magic moment when to comment on something and the laugh is killed. Or there are a lot of people, actors particularly, who think they can reword a joke and put it in their own language and make it more comfortable and funnier, but they put in a couple of extra syllables. Humor is a rhythm. It's like music. You put in a couple of extra syllables, you kill the laugh.
You know, everyone asks you, is there anything you want to do that you haven't done? Do you still answer Robert Redford?
In my head, I do.
He sent you a poem, but you wouldn't publish it in the book?
He's a very private person, and I wasn't going to exploit what he was fun enough and kind enough to do. I've never met him. Mm-hmm. I would be so embarrassed if I met him because I've taken his name in vain so often. But when I got the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Screen Actors Guild, he sent me this congratulatory poem, and it was just adorable. So I've had my moment, my Robert Redford moment that I treasure, that he sent me that.
Even the book jacket refers to you as it girl, Betty White.
Oh.
Really, really. So
that's rank sarcasm. You know that.
I don't think so. I think it fits. I want to know, all of your success has not gone to your head. How have you managed to do this, especially now that we seem to be in this age of celebrity madness?
Well, don't you think you know yourself better than anybody else knows you? And you know how overrated you are, so you can't feel too smart. I address it in the book. My mother also taught me to, if you lie to anybody on the planet, don't lie to that person reflected in the mirror. Always be able to meet your own eyes and know that you're telling the truth.
Betty White's new memoir is called If You Ask Me, and of course you won't. And she joined us from member station WNYC in New York. Thank you, and best of luck in your next endeavors.
Oh, thank you, Leanne, so much, and I hope I talk to you again.
I hope so, too.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. The hearts of comic book fans are aflutter today. That's because tomorrow, comic book stores around the world will give away millions of comics. Mark your calendars. It's the 10th annual Free Comic Book Day. As Rob St. Mary of member station WDET reports, it's become an increasingly important way to bring people into stores as comics go electronic.
This is kind of our front display space.
Walking among the well-organized racks, Dan Merritt, the owner of Green Brain Comics in Dearborn, Michigan, says he has a little something for everyone.
We got high class and low brow right next to each other.
Merritt says his passion for comics, which started as a kid, fires his 12-year-old business he runs with his wife, Katie.
That's pretty much the major characteristic of this business, constant change and constant evolution of the way we do business.
One of the things that's changed since Merritt opened his shop is the creation of Free Comic Book Day. Joe Field, the owner of Flying Colors Comics in Concord, California, came up with the idea.
To call back people who used to read comics but haven't for a while for whatever reason, to introduce new people to comics and to do sort of a thank you party to our regular readers and fans.
And they deserve it. In 2001, the industry's leading distributor, Diamond, says it saw about $330 million in sales. Over the past decade, that number has jumped as high as $430 million before cashing in last year at $418 million. One reason for the growth might be the very public battle between the biggest comic book publishers, Marvel and DC. It's a fight that's not only playing out at the racks, but at the multiplex.
I am Iron Man. The suit and I are one.
Iron Man is just one of Marvel's many characters doing battle at the box office. Thor attacks the big screen today. Meanwhile, DC is counterpunched with films like The Dark Knight, which has taken in over $1 billion worldwide.
Know your limits, Master Wayne.
Batman has no limits.
Participants in the Nerdy Book Club might agree.
Thank you for coming, everyone. Batman Dark Knight Returns.
About 20 or so people are gathered at Brian Kelly's Detroit Comics in Ferndale, Michigan. They're enjoying snacks and a few beers.
Hi, my name's Angela. Guys.
That's Angela Badgett, a regular at the monthly book club meetings because she likes what comics and graphic novels have to offer.
Things that are geared towards women as far as literature these days is sad.
And while she prefers the printed page, Badgett says she does own an e-reader.
There might be a limit to the individual issue comic books. You know, that might end at some point, but I don't think that the genre will ever go away. The medium might change.
There are apps that allow readers to purchase, store, and view digital comics on their phones and e-readers. But Green Brain owner Dan Merritt says brick-and-mortar retailers have a plan. Starting this fall, they'll get a leg up on the digital world with some help from publishers. Merritt says if Angela wanted the latest issue of, say, Spider-Man for her e-reader, she would have to come to a store and purchase a code.
We will have 30 days exclusivity for that download. The only way you can get that download is coming to a comic store.
Merritt says retailers have learned from the drop in sales at traditional bookstores and the struggles of the big chains that comic shop owners must provide an experience customers can't get online. That's why Merritt says Free Comic Book Day is huge for growing his store's clientele.
We tend to pick up anywhere 5 to 10% as regular revisiting customers. We estimate a much larger percentile that occasionally revisit throughout the year.
So Merritt says it's more than worth it to pay 50 cents an issue for the special editions he'll be giving away. But don't be surprised if he tries to talk you into buying one of his current favorites, the latest issue of the zombie saga, The Walking Dead. For NPR News, I'm Rob St. Mary in Detroit.